Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Lexington just celebrated the 250th anniversary of its founding in 1775, 1 year before the signing of the Declaration of Independence. This year, 2026, is the nation's 250th, and we're going to explore that history. Later in this hour, the lives and nature of a people who had lived in our region for millennia before 1775, the Shawnee. And we'll hear about recognition of women in Fayette County whose names may not appear on historical plaques or statues, but whose work has shaped daily life. First, Eastern Standard contributor Kevin Nance is joined by writer and educator Christine Yoey and renowned poet Frank X. Walker, whose body of work has long challenged how the American story is told. Their recent collaboration, Reckoning with the Past, the Historical Poetry of Frank X. Walker, offers a poetic confrontation with trauma, erasure, resilience, and the stubborn endurance of hope. Their conversation with Kevin Nance explores how poetry can function as historical lens, emotional archive, and moral compass. We hear how Walker approaches the past with both accountability and compassion, and how Yoey's engagement with his work helps us navigate the complexities of history.
So, Christine, what was the origin of this book? How did you decide to take on this topic?
Well, I've been teaching the Appalachian poets ever since I learned about them in 2001, right after Frank's first book, Appalachia, was published. I've been teaching selections from them. And it was in 2013 when the Medgar Evers book came out that I decided to teach that whole book in an introductory English major class that I'd been teaching. And my students' response to it was just so excited that it, you know, it stimulated me to do more. And I have a colleague, John Cullick, who actually a good proud alum of UK, who told me his English education students were doing their pedagogy projects on Turn Me Loose, The Unghosting of Medgar Evers, Frank X. Walker's book that they'd learned in my class. And that stimulated me to think more about teaching more of his work and teaching more of the Appalachian poets. And it was the really positive experience of teaching that led me to stimulated me to want to write the book.
Frank, what is the reason that one chooses to write about historical figures as opposed to writing about the here and now or writing about yourself? I know as a poet myself that sometimes I get tired of myself as a subject and I want to look out. And I don't usually look back into history as you have, but could you speak to that?
Yeah, I can try. I think for me, it's not that I'm bored with myself. I think I'm more interested in historical figures and topics, especially those stories and narratives that have been undertold or mistold or have a wrinkle, a layer about them that is so exciting that I think it deserves to be a feature film. For me, that gets me excited about the topic and the character or the person or historical moment, and I just want to raise it to something higher. And I think poetry can do that.
Well, certainly the people that you've written about, except for maybe Medgar Evers, I think he's near enough historically in time. And also, you know, I think that's a name that people know to a certain extent. York, not so much. And, we know about Isaac Murphy here in Lexington, but probably not much elsewhere, I'm guessing. I don't know. I could be wrong about that. Why did you choose those three to focus on in your historical poetry? And did you learn something about them that you wouldn't have found from the history books? And did you convey something about them that a reader could not have found in a history book?
Absolutely. I think that if there wasn't material and information available in the narratives I advanced, it wouldn't be worth doing the book. It wouldn't be worth the research. And for me, even in the case where people seemed like they might be almost cliche, in the case of Medgar Evers, Medgar doesn't speak in the book about him and his story. It's his widow, Mary Evers. It's primarily the voice of the assassin, Byron Day LeBeckwith, Medgar's brother, Charles, has something to say. And then there's the kind of generic Greek choir voice that, you know, speaks as the historical voice that kind of balances out the story. So I think it's those stories that come from the supporting characters. In the case of Isaac Murphy, it's Isaac's wife, Lucy. It's his mother, America Burns. It's his teacher. You know, those kind of prop up the story. And of course, case of York, it was easy because we hadn't heard from York. So I just left out Lewis and Clark and let York tell the story. So, and I think it changes the story dramatically just by putting it in a different voice and a different point of view.
For our listeners to this interview who may not know, could you explain who York was? And both of you chime in on that.
I'll give that one to the doctor.
Well, York was the enslaved black man who was the technical property of William Clark, of Lewis and Clark fame. And he was one of the members of the Corps of Discovery, the group that 1804, 1806 did the Lewis and Clark exploration, what we all learn about in school. And it's, you know, he was the unsung member of that group. I mean, I will tell you, in my third grade class in Durham, North Carolina, I did a book report about Sacagawea back, you know, in what, late 60s, early 70s. So we knew about her to an extent, but nobody talked about York. And he was a full-fledged member of the Corps of Discovery. He was a voting member of the Corps of Discovery. He saved the lives of the white soldiers and captains. And he deserves credit and he deserves a voice. And the fact that Frank has been able to resurrect him and give him that voice, I think, tells us something about history that we don't get from a history book. A history book, you know, can be beautifully written, and you can learn a lot from it in your brain. But I think literature and art help us learn in our heart, in our guts.
Not all history books are equal, either. Some do a better job of telling the full story than others, is
absolutely
what I'm saying.
Oh, absolutely. And I think some history books don't intend to be false, but I think once we accept something as history, in the way we've been socialized, we assume it's the truth. No matter how many points of view it's left out, you know, a lot of American history is told from the point of view of the conqueror. You know, most stories about the West don't even include Native American input or voices or points of view. And that's something I try to fix in the second York book, you know, called When Winter Come. You know, to the voice of women, the voice of Native peoples, in a way that was even more respectful of the story. Because I think that my mother used to say that there are two sides to every story, and then there's the truth. And the truth is the sum total of everybody's point of view. And if only one person is telling a story, that's just one way to hear the story. And it's not quite the truth yet.
York is also unusual in your output in that he's the subject of not one, not two, but three books, one of which is yet to be published. Tell us why you kept going back to York, and you wouldn't have realized probably that you were writing what will ultimately be a trilogy.
Absolutely not. When I finished the first one, I knew I was done. In fact, I had to be convinced to start the second one. And then after the second one was done, I knew I was done until I was convinced to write the third one. But I'm very proud of the fact that, you know, they're all different. But the story is so big, there's room for all these different points of views. And not just a third book, but, you know, I'm looking forward to the feature film.
You know? Well, I was going to ask you, you mentioned in your first answer that, you know, you wanted to elevate it so that it becomes worthy of a feature film. There is indeed a feature film in the works?
Absolutely. It's in pre-production, being made by California filmmakers, if that means something to film people. I think it does. You know, Khalil Joseph is the filmmaker, who's an amazing visual artist, you know, from a family of artists, and I have so much respect for his work. In fact, you know, he was one who encouraged me to think seriously about a third book. When he first approached me, I told him really quickly that there is no third book. And I was wrong.
What made you change your mind?
Well, it happened when we had a phone call in the mountains. I think I was in West Virginia, riding through the mountains. And he planted this idea on this long drive home to Kentucky. And so the rest of the way on the drive with no music playing, I just thought about what York's life would have been like 10 years after the expedition, what he would have done, and how much I disbelieve Clark's version of York's demise. Clark said that York perished on the way back to him with the intent of becoming his slave again. And
no way.
That makes no sense to me after all he experienced, especially in the great Northwest. It made more sense to me that he would go back out west and be with his family. So that's the direction of the third book.
Ah, okay. What is the process like, Frank and Christine, as you see it too, for inhabiting the minds and voices of these characters? I'm guessing that there's a fine line between sort of being a ventriloquist and being someone who is channeling that person in a way. Is there a moment when you feel like you've achieved some kind of a mind meld with the character, the person, and that you are then empowered to speak in his voice or her voice?
First, I want to pay respect to that Star Trek reference with the mind melding, but...
That's right.
I wish it was that easy, but the truth is it's driven by research. The reasons that the historical poetry collections include pages and pages of notes and bibliographies is to pay homage to the importance of research. And I think that, you know, this idea that I have about a combination of memory research and imagination, plus empathy, of course, that's the only way you can write these kinds of stories and do it in an honest way. You could do it and invent all of it and do it all from imagination, but it wouldn't hold up well in history classes and with historical audiences. And I wanted to write these kinds of books that held weight and sway with historians and people who loved history and people who love poetry at the same time. And I think that's two different audiences.
It has to feel earned in a way.
And the research is the only way you can earn that, because if you get one thing wrong, somebody will call you on it. And that's what historians do. I mean, they are about facts.
Well, going back to the mind meld, you do sort of become that person in a way. And I wonder whether, you know, you catch yourself speaking as some sort of an amalgam of yourself and the speaker. Does that make sense? Does that ever happen?
Well, if I hear the question correctly, I think what you're stating is how authentic the voices sound. And I would point immediately to the voices of women in those collections. I think that my research has influenced those voices, but so has my lived reality. I have seven sisters. I was raised by women, so I'm very comfortable in those voices. There's not a lot of distance, maybe a couple of hundred years between me and York, but I can imagine being in those situations, you know, that he was in to a certain degree. And it was highly informed by the research. I actually went out on the Lewis and Clark Trail with my son, and we spent real time in the same space to try to get closer to the story. You know, I went down to Mississippi, to Jackson, to do research. You know, I went to Keeneland, I went to the backside, I went to horse parks and horse farms and talked to horse people to get as much knowledge as possible, to be in those same spaces, to do the research, to sound as authentic as possible. I think that's what you hear. I don't know if it reads like that, you know, Chris could comment on that, but that was the goal.
Christine, what is your take on Frank's treatment of Byron de la Beckwith?
Oh, wow.
Which must have been maybe the biggest leap that you ever had to take in these books.
I think it's what really makes a big difference in that book, because I think what Frank does with the research for York and with the research for the characters, the personae that are more sympathetic, is huge. You can tell, you know, his MRI, memory, research, and imagination. He's got a whole essay explaining how his approach, plus empathy, that heart that he brings to it. That's huge for the characters that we like. For someone like Byron De La Beckwith, I think it's astonishing, and I find my students astonished, that we don't get simply a monster. Certainly, he's a reprehensible human being that none of us admire, but we understand him in a way that I think is healing. And it was quite frankly the introduction to the Medgar Evers book, where Frank said he wanted to tell the story in a way to help our country heal, that made me think about writing about all of his historical poetry with a similar endeavor. It's not the same thing, but they all are trying to go back and uncover someone who's been covered in order to have us know a fuller truth, in order for the country to have a sense of healing. And, you know, racial reconciliation is quite an idealized goal, but it doesn't mean we don't strive for it. But Byron, I think, is unique in that, in the whole cadre of the voices that Frank writes in. But what I find most helpful for me, and I think for my students, is we hear about Byron from Merle, from the widow of Medgar Evers. We hear her voice go back and say, "What if?" which is a question Frank asks a lot throughout his poetry, including personal poetry, including poetry about his family. But what if Byron De La Beckwith had not been radicalized, to use a maybe appropriate word? What if Byron De La Beckwith had not lost his parents young? What if he had not become full of hate? What if he had seen another way? What if that could have been different? And I think Merle's perspective on Byron is what helps me not just dismiss him out of hand. And I think if we're going to heal as a country, as a world, we have to recognize the humanity of people who may seem like unforgivable monsters and may be unforgivable monsters, but were not always. They were once children. And Merle's questioning of that really helps me, and I see it every semester. And I see my students go, "Wow, okay, I didn't expect to get into Byron's mind in a way that makes me recognize why he did what he did."
It seems like the book is timely in an uncomfortable sort of way, in the sense that the current administration and much of the national discourse is devoted to the idea that talking about racism and talking about its roots in slavery and the long, dark history of race in America is seen as divisive. It is seen as setting us against each other. And I have heard it spelled out very bluntly as, you know, critical race theory, for example, is thought to be designed to make white people feel bad. And I think that clashes with Frank's interest in heading toward reconciliation. But, you know, you have to face what's there before you can reconcile it. We have to be clear about what really happened and how it affected people. Could you speak to that, both of you?
Well, I'll just say that I think my students and I, with the Medgar Evers book, but with I've taught the York books as well and the Isaac Murphy book. I've taught all of his historical poetry. I've only taught selections from Loden 9 times, the newest book. But I think for all of them, it's really liberating to learn about what has been hidden. I find students sometimes angry to know what else was hidden from them. What other knowledge were they denied? But they are glad to finally see that. And that's true for Black and white students and students of all ethnicities that I teach in my classroom. I mean, we're strong enough to handle the truth. And telling it with compassion, as Frank's literature does, it's not about shame or blame. It's about knowledge, and knowledge is growth, and it's healing, and I think it's sorely needed. And my commitment to teaching this literature is even stronger in the current environment.
And you haven't found it divisive among your students?
No, because I openly say we're not trying to make anybody feel shame or blame. And quite frankly, Black students can sometimes feel shame, too, if all they hear is slavery. You know, it's important to talk about Black brilliance and Black accomplishment, and a lot of the literature does. It depends on how you do it, but you do it sensitively and carefully, and the students respond beautifully. But what makes a big difference is the literature. I mean, I had a student years ago, a white student, tell me that he had struggled with his own racism until he read Frederick Douglass's narrative, and then his heart opened. And that's a beautiful, giant thing that art can do. And Frank's literature does that.
Frank, did you mean to be divisive?
I reject that notion that I am divisive.
Of course not.
Yeah, I might be subversive in my intent to write what I write, but I think that the idea that history is divisive is nonsense. You know, I think there are parts of history that will make you uncomfortable.
Absolutely.
Period. And I think that if you think history should only be the stories that make you feel good about who you are and what you've done, then that's a lie. And if that's what we want to teach children, then we're teaching a lie. And I think that this idea that you can scrub and sanitize and cleanse the truth in history is not just wrongheaded, but it's setting children up for failure. And this erasure that institutions seem committed to is going to have some kind of pushback. And I think that what a lot of writers are doing and what artists are doing is recognizing that and still committing themselves to the truth. And I think that I'm not trying to write revisionist history. I'm trying to write the truth. I'm trying to write towards the truth. I'm trying to make sure that more voices are represented. There's no way we should learn about the Lewis and Clark expedition and not hear from Native Americans. It's ridiculous. There's no way that we should hear about the Civil War and not include a conversation about slavery or enslavement. That's ridiculous. We have to tell the whole story, but not tell it slant, you know, tell the truth. And this idea that the truth is divisive, I think is just some comfortable rhetoric that individuals who either don't know the truth because they haven't read many books or they failed history, haven't understood that you can learn from history. If that's going to be, you know, the kind of through line to tell one kind of history or to not tell it, then look how many holidays we don't get to celebrate anymore. That means no more Memorial Day, right? I mean, it's based on something that happened historically that was ugly for a lot of people. No more national cemeteries. You know, why? You'd have to erase so much if you start down this long slope of erasing parts of the truth just to make a certain element of our society comfortable. And I think that's just wrongheaded. I say lean into that discomfort, because on the other side of it is something better. And that's where I think we need to figure out how to get to, period.
Absolutely.
Well, Frank and Christine, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Coming up after the break.
The Shawnees had a very, very involved and deep and long-lasting footprint in what is now the state of Kentucky.
And recognizing the unrecognized caregivers, teachers, cafeteria workers, and other women whose contributions to life happen behind the scenes. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at WEKU.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. Who was here in what is now Kentucky before the arrival of colonial explorers and settlers? Archaeologists document the continuous presence of indigenous people for more than 12,000 years in what's now Kentucky. the Delaware, Miami, Wyandotte, Haudenosaunee, Iroquois, Potawatomi, Ottawa, Kickapoo, Cherokee, Chickasaw, and, the focus of today's interview, the Shawnee. Joining us from the University of Iowa, where he teaches American Studies, is Stephen Warren, author of The Shawnees and Their Neighbors, 1795 to 1870, The Eastern Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma, Resilience Through Adversity, and The Worlds the Shawnees Made. Dr. Warren is deeply infused with not only an understanding of Shawnee recorded history, but he's also deeply involved with Shawnee people today. So he's able to see simultaneously the present state of Shawnee people and to look back in time with an authentic and broad view of the sweep of Shawnee history as it's recorded. Dr. Warren, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you so much, Tom, for that generous introduction. I look forward to our conversation.
Well, our aim in this series is to explore what's known about the histories of the peoples who inhabited our area, starting many thousands of years before the arrival of Daniel Boone and others, ancient farmers and hunting and gathering peoples, ancient native engineers and plant domesticators, and their modern descendants who we know by the names of Shawnee, Cherokee, Chickasaw, Tutelo, and Uchi. So I wanted to ask you first, what attracted you to the Shawnee story?
Well, I had the great good fortune of taking a wonderful class as an undergraduate with a scholar named R. David Edmonds. He wrote two biographies, one of Tecumseh and the other of the Shawnee prophet. And it was from studying with Dave, learning from him, that I became really intrigued about the story of the survivors of Tecumseh and the Shawnee prophet. So I kind of wanted to pick up the story from the War of 1812.
And Tecumseh and the Shawnee prophet were brothers, is that correct?
Yes, they were brothers. And they're very much misunderstood because so many of the sources that we have about them were recorded by their enemies. And so we have to do some pretty good detective work to get at the truth behind these individuals.
What are some important misunderstandings about these two individuals?
Well, I think one is the primacy of Tecumseh. He is a celebrated warrior. He died at the Battle of the Thames in 1813, resisting the United States. And in Canada, he's thought of as the savior of Canada from American imperialism. So notwithstanding those accomplishments, I think oftentimes his brother, Tenskwatawa, the Shawnee prophet, is diminished by comparison. He's described as a bad hunter, an alcoholic, a wife beater, you name it. Tenskwatawa has been described as such. And it's important to note that many of these sources on his inability to hunt or his proclivity for alcohol come from the memories of settlers collected by Lyman Drake Draper, sometimes 50 to 60 years after the fact. And so they're very much suspect sources. We've learned recently from the reports of Christians who actually visited Tenskwatawa in 1805 and 1807. People who were part of the Cane Ridge Revival were fascinated by him and traveled to meet him. And the sources they left from him paint a very different picture. Of a sober-minded person who is very much enraptured by what they described as the Holy Spirit. And so a subject of great importance and a real leader of the people.
So interesting. The Kentucky archaeologist Gwen Henderson has written that incorrect ideas about Native peoples in what is now Kentucky range from the specific, how they dressed, how their houses appeared, how they made a living, what languages they spoke, to the general, the diversity of their way of life, the length of their presence here, their place of origin, their spiritual beliefs, and the organization of their political and economic systems. Your focus is on the Shawnee. What does archival research tell us about characteristics that distinguish the Shawnee way of life?
Oh, that's an excellent question. Well, in The Worlds the Shawnees Made, a distinguishing characteristic of the Shawnee people was the range of their migrations across North America. And so all Native people in the era of colonialism, you know, from the period of Hernando de Soto's expedition from 1539 to 1542 to really Indian removal in 1830, all Native people in that zone of time migrated in order to survive. But the Shawnee people did so on steroids. And so their migrations were often hundreds, if not thousands, of miles from their home base in the Ohio Valley. And the different kinds of people that they settled among, whether they were Muscogean or Spanish-speaking colonizers or French colonizers or Iroquoian speakers, the range is simply unrivaled by others. And so a subtitle or an oft-used title in my book is that the Shawnees were the greatest travelers in America, at least according to people who knew them.
You have researched and read archival documents curated in Canada and Spain, as well as all of the various archives in Washington and at the Newberry Library in Chicago. Mm-hmm. What sorts of insights have you gained from this work that you felt there wasn't time or space to include in your books?
Gosh, that's a great question. I think one of the insights of the archival research is simply that we often imagine Native Americans and colonizers as being repellent to each other, but the archival evidence told me a different story, which is that Native Americans and colonizers were actually drawn toward each other. And so as people migrated, they really traveled to colonial hotspots where they could trade and learn from colonizers and Native people alike. And it created a pretty extraordinary frontier exchange economy. And getting back to the kind of misunderstandings that Gwen Henderson indicates, Native cultures changed quite dramatically in the period of colonization. And so they're often mischaracterized as savage by colonial people. But in fact, Native people were very much part of a common culture with colonizers.
Yeah, I want to touch on that characterization in just a minute. But first, was there anything about the organization of Shawnee political and economic life that contributed to their response to the arrival of the Europeans in the region?
Yeah, that's a great question as well, Tom. And I think a distinctive characteristic of the Shawnee and really their central Algonquian neighbors, so these would be people such as the Miami or the Potawatomi or the Kickapoo, a characteristic of them is that these are village-based societies. So political authority does not go beyond that. They don't have a sense of themselves politically as a nation. So their allegiance is primarily to village chiefs. And so one of the challenges of writing Shawnee history is that you'll have one village that speaks Shawnee and practices an identical culture to related villages. You'll have that one village travel in a very different way than another. You'll have one village make an alliance with one colonizer while another village will make an entirely different or opposing alliance. And it's because this is a village-based political system. They're small but sophisticated.
History books, a number of them, in fact, here in Kentucky, have told us that what is now Kentucky was once a dark and bloody hunting ground, as it's put, yeah. Pretty much devoid of inhabitants. And I take it that's a myth. What does your research tell you about this?
Yeah, you know, the contemporary Shawnee people have been for many, many years inspired to fulfill the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. This is a 1990 law that is a federal law that protects Native American graves and funerary objects when they're discovered. And in Kentucky, before 1990, there were a number of really pretty egregious attacks on Native American graves where they were looted, for example. And some of those desecrations contributed to the passage of the NAGPRA law. So this is a long way of saying that since 1990, the three federally recognized Shawnee tribes have been really dedicated to finding out and locating where their pre-contact villages were. So they've done a lot of research on this. And in fact, they have a private database, which I helped construct, with an inventory of those villages. And the number of them in Kentucky and the extent to which they push into the historic period up to the 1770s is remarkable. So the Shawnees had a very, very involved and deep and long-lasting footprint in what is now the state of Kentucky, as with parts of southeastern Indiana and much of southern Ohio.
Well, how did the Shawnee understanding of land and the concept of ownership differ from the perspective of the European Americans who came into the region?
Yeah, you know, almost no American today will use the word usufruct when talking about land. But usufructuary rights are rights in which people have a right to hunt, fish, and gather on land that they don't actually own. And so, you know, when we go out and we hunt on public land or we fish on a public lake, you know, we're exercising our usufructuary rights. And usufructuary rights in Western law are roughly commensurate with how Native people imagined their land use rights. That is to say, they had a specific village-based territory that they believed was theirs, but they also shared a much larger hunting ground, oftentimes 200 to 300 miles from that central point of the summer village. And in their movement across the summer hunting ground, that would be seasonal. So from summer to winter, people migrated in pursuit of game. They would share that property, that land, with other hunters. And so this idea of land sharing and fair use were pretty common to Native Americans. I should add, it's a little bit like, if you were to look at, for those history buffs in the room, it would be like going to England before the enclosure movement ended all of the commons. You know, people who raised their sheep on a common plot, or, you know, gathered in a shared forest, you know, in the 1500s. This was very common in the United Kingdom, but it all ended in the period of colonialism.
Well, going back to something that you touched on earlier, our listeners probably may know that the Shawnee were sort of the bogeyman during the early settlement frontier period. It was the Shawnee that took Boone and Kenton. It was the Shawnee who led the raids against Boonesboro. To listen to Kentucky's early pioneers, it was nothing but the Shawnee, even though we know that the Cherokee, the Tutelo, the Uchi also lived in the area. Central Kentucky is viewed by the Shawnee people, as I understand it, as their home, perhaps ancient home. And that is true?
Yes, that is true. It's a mischaracterization that's meant to insinuate that Native people gave up their claim to Kentucky, and that is not true. But what did occur is the slave trade in Native peoples combined with epidemic disease and Iroquois warfare, that did make the Ohio Valley a pretty tough place to be between roughly 1540 and 1700. And Native people remember their homeland and they return to it after 1701 and the Great Peace of Montreal. So we see Native people reappearing in their former homelands after a pretty long diaspora caused by the intense violence. But they don't forget where they're from. They know.
How would you characterize the Shawnee people, culture, family, society, even worldview, as compared to the stereotypes or offhanded characterizations of the Shawnee people and what's been written about them by others?
Yeah, you know, One of the funny things about Native American history is we love Native Americans in times of war. I mean, the American appetite for stories about Tecumseh is insatiable. Probably every 2 years, a new book comes out about Tecumseh. And I bet you if you were to look at any Native nation, you know, whether we're talking about Sitting Bull or Geronimo, we're fascinated by them at that point of violence with settlement. And so what this has done is it's deformed our collective understanding of who Native people were. They've kind of become warriors, but I would say about 35% of the high schools in Ohio and Indiana have a Native American themed mascot. And typically those themes are, you know, the warriors, the Indians, et cetera. And it pictures a man, you know, who's a fighter. And, you know, it's important to remind folks that Native people were more than war. You know, they were also people who planted corn, who tapped maple sugar trees, who hunted deer, who had their own particular worldview. And so when we become kind of myopically focused on battles and warriors, we lose sight of the whole picture. That's kind of my perspective.
What are the current concerns today of the Shawnee people with respect to their history, their legacy, their identity?
Yeah, thank you so much for asking this question, Tom. And, you know, I hope that you get an opportunity to visit with a Shawnee person on your show and hear from them. But what I've learned is that, you know, undoing the legacy of removal is a very important thing to Native people now resident in Oklahoma, whose lands once included Kentucky or Ohio or Indiana or Illinois. So what does undoing removal look like? I'd love to explore that with you. But one of the things that it means is, you know, for example, respecting Native American cemeteries and skeletons and the funerary objects that were interred with people. But it can also mean things like inviting folks to come back and have those conversations about what the land meant. So it's pretty wide-ranging.
Have you ever thought about what life in areas formerly inhabited by Native Americans would be like if they had not been forcibly removed?
Oh, gosh. You're so much fun to talk to, Tom, I have to tell you. I really appreciate, you know, all of your questions. And you know, something that I just would like to point out to people is that the number of folks removed from their homeland was vanishingly small. You know, so when we're talking about the Shawnee people, we're talking, you know, in 1830 about, at least in the census records, fewer than 2,000 people. Hmm. Some of these nations, you know, were fewer than 1,000 people, but they were all forced to remove from their lands. And so the question that I often ask myself is, why did the federal government waste so much blood and treasure on removing people who were no longer a threat to them militarily or economically?
It's a good question.
I mean, you can't tell me that, you know, 300 people in Lewistown, Ohio were an existential threat to the United States.
What would you say inspires you most, Steve, about the Shawnee people? What can we learn from them?
Oh, gosh, so much. You know, something that I really admire about the people I know in Oklahoma is their sense of humor, their kindness, their generosity, but also their toughness. And so if you stop and think about it, you know, we've all been through a lot. You know, I think about like my ancestors, you know, and some of whom were at Jamestown and mm-hmm. some of the things that they've seen, you know,
right.
in order for me to be here. It's pretty remarkable. But Native Americans, the Shawnee people, for example, continue to speak their language, to practice their pre-contact ceremonies, to give names to their children in the Shawnee language. The list goes on and on. And so you have to be pretty tough people to maintain that over hundreds of years of colonialism.
That's University of Iowa Professor of American Studies Stephen Warren, author of The Shawnees and Their Neighbors, 1795 to 1870, The Eastern Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma, Resilience Through Adversity, and The Worlds the Shawnees Made. And we thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you for listening, everybody.
In every community, there are people whose names don't appear on plaques or their likenesses are not captured in statues, but their work has in some way shaped daily life in lasting ways. In Fayette County, a collaboration between the League of Women Voters and the Lexington History Museum is working to make those contributions known. It's called Stand With Her Story, a project collecting short 250-word stories about women whose impact has often happened quietly. Caregivers, teachers, cafeteria workers, neighbors. Joining me now is Sylvia Lovely, one of the organizers of the project. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Sylvia.
Thank you, Tom. So good to be here.
And before we talk about how this works, let's start with the heart of it. What is Stand With Her Story trying to do?
It's a way to recognize women that don't normally stand on the podium and get the big award. What we did with this, though, is we didn't want to, you know, put too much of a fence around it. So we've asked people to submit the name of women, and this is very important, it's women who have been underrepresented in history, and to put their words down, 250 words, to describe the impact that that woman had on their lives in Fayette County.
250 words is not a lot of space. Why that length?
250 because it's easier, right? You can do it more quickly. And what my fear would have been is that people thought, oh, if I have to write a lot of words or there's no real fence around it. So 250, and, you know, we do get comments, oh, gosh, you know, I don't write. But 250 words to succinctly describe that impact so that we can get as many of them as we can so that we can publicize them.
And what kinds of stories are you looking for?
Let me give you examples, because they're all over the map. One of them, particularly poignant, a young woman. We have a young woman as part of our smaller group. I love having youth involved in this. Mm-hmm. And it's her young friend, who's probably not much older than her, maybe 30. And she has two small children. And she fought and won the war of breast cancer. And it's about that journey that this friend went on and how she made such an impact and was so inspirational in being able to get through that. Another one, the one that I submitted. I love that one, Freda Merriweather, who was my executive assistant for 10 years. And Tom, I was the one that got awards and, you know, contacted to be on stage. Freda never was. And so I got to tell her story. But she works with veterans. She's active in her church at Shiloh Baptist. Just amazing woman.
Well, what would you say to somebody who's thinking, gosh, I'd like to do this, but I'm not a writer? And does this idea really count? What would you say to them?
Oh, I would say, go for it. Just get in there, write it up. It doesn't have to be fancy. You know, that's not like writing a well-constructed short story. It's just telling it from your heart. That passion of telling about that teacher that made a difference in your life. We have all got one, don't we? And to just put that together, make an outline. And that's always a great way to do it. That's what I tell my story people that are taking my classes. Begin with your premise. What's your end goal? And then write that first sentence right in the middle, exactly what it is you want to tell about this person, the impact they made on your life, when it was, and finish with a strong finish.
Okay, let's say somebody's listening to us right now. The light bulb's gone off. They want to do this.
Mm-hmm.
What do they have to do?
Well, what they have to do is go to our website, lwvlexington.com/her story. And they will see a place where they can submit that story. There are flyers all over town where you can go to that code, QR code, and you can find that right away. And just go ahead and submit it.
This project brings together the League of Women Voters, mm-hmm. the Lexington History Museum. What does that partnership make possible that might not happen
otherwise?
Oh, great question, because those are phenomenal organizations. The Lexington History Museum is a treasure. If you go in there, you know, and many people don't, but hopefully this can even help with that, awakening people to our history, Tom, the stories of our history, how important those are to inspire us to even do greater things. As I've looked through the list and read some of them, I'm like, this is amazing. I want to be part of it. The League of Women Voters is an old, venerable organization. So you put those two powerhouses together, you've got a lot more than, say, I could do all by myself. It's publicity. It's getting the word out. And that's what's important.
Yeah, Mandy Higgins, the executive director of the museum, is pretty amazing, kind of a walking encyclopedia herself.
I agree.
Well, when you look ahead, Sylvia, what do you hope Fayette County gains from having these stories told and remembered?
Well, it's what history teaches us all the time. These are going to be, one, we're going to read the names of every person who is nominated or submitted. Let me not say nominated, because that sounds like you're in a competition. Every name that's submitted will be read in March. No date's been set. Women's History Month. And it'll be in front of the statue that's downtown in support of women and their history. And also there'll be a display at the Lexington History Museum, a kiosk, where you can go read about your mom, for instance. Or you can go read about your executive assistant that never really got the due that she deserved. And you can learn from that history, I mean, that rich history. I was just reading one today, and I didn't know about this organization, Tom. And if you did, oh, I'm ashamed of myself for not knowing. And it's called Black Yarn, Amazing Women. Mm-hmm. And those were nominated, all three of those women.
Good to
were
hear.
Nominated. And one of them was Rona Roberts. But she's always done amazing work. She's not asked to be recognized. She's just doing that work, like her cornbread suppers and all of that. But this is about Black Yarn, which is about segregated communities and the impact that those have on our lives. And she does it through storytelling, which is, oh, my favorite way to tell a story.
Well, we're really looking forward to this. That's Sylvia Lovely with Stand With Her Story, a collaborative project of the League of Women Voters and the Lexington History Museum, collecting 250-word stories about women whose work has mattered, often quietly but profoundly, in Fayette County. Thank you, Sylvia.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while there, you can check out our contributors and their interviews. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Have a question or topic you'd like to suggest? If you'd like to hear your question or suggestion as the prompt for a segment on Eastern Standard, record it on your smart device and send us the MP3 with your first name only and location. You can email that as an attachment to es@eku.edu with question for ES in the subject line. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.